you are standing at the precipice of both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say Black Lives Matter rather than All Lives Matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. My guest today is Gleb Sapirsky, professor at Ohio State University, author of the new book, The Truth Seeker's Handbook, A Science-Based Guide, and co-founder of the Pro-Truth Pledge. It's an online instrument intended to encourage lawmakers, journalists, and all of us to commit to fact-checking the material we share on social media, in traditional media, political campaigns, and even just with our Facebook friends, all in the name of rational, fact-based discourse. Sapirsky, who's concerned about the way politicians manipulate the public with fake news and even encourage a post-truth politics, hopes that this pledge, by publicly committing us to truth-telling and correcting our mistakes when we make them, can restore a spirit of rational inquiry to our everyday lives. As an expert on the way our brains are wired for irrationality, he's especially concerned about the way social media has encouraged us to seek out and often hear only those bits of information that comport with our pre-existing worldview. But the good news is, there are ways to short-circuit our irrational tendencies and move in a more rational direction. And we'll be talking about that today on Speak Out with Tim Wise. Well, today, because I'm going to be speaking with Gleb Sapirsky about the issue of fake news, among other things, and the way that our brains oftentimes process political information in ways that simply reinforce our pre-existing biases, I thought it would be a really opportune moment to talk about one such piece of fake news. It is a persistent and oft-claimed piece of fake news, which nonetheless is believed by millions of people and continues to be repeated by people on the right. Whenever the issue of civil rights and racism comes up, I'm sure you've heard it before. It is the claim you'll hear from far-right folks and Republicans that, well, you know, the Democrats were the party of slavery, and the Democrats were the party of segregation, and it was the Republicans, right, who were the party of abolition, Abraham Lincoln. It was the Republicans in Congress who were the reason we got civil rights laws passed. The Democrats were the ones who were racist, and the Republicans were the ones who believed in civil rights and equal rights for all. This came up again this week. As you know, this past week, actually, Donald Trump traveled to Jackson, Mississippi to attend the opening of the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum there. And he did this amid quite a bit of protest and the refusal on the part of Congressman John Lewis and Congressman Benny Thompson to attend the ceremony so long as Trump was going to be there, as well as the mayor of Jackson, who refused to come for the same reason. And so in the middle of that controversy, there has obviously been a plethora of conservative and Republican spokespersons who have tried to defend the president being at the Civil Rights Museum in Jackson and who have attacked John Lewis, for instance, who was, of course, a hero of the civil rights movement, getting his head cracked open by racists while Donald Trump was marching around at a military academy, learning the real estate business from his racist father, and then ultimately discriminating against black people in housing in violation of the Fair Housing Act of 1968, one of the great accomplishments of that movement. So they attack John Lewis, they attack the critics of Donald Trump, and one of the arguments they make is, well, this is absurd. I mean, after all, the Democrats were the party of segregation. The Democrats were the opponents of civil rights. The Republicans were the heroes. The stupidity of this argument boggles the imagination. It's almost impossible to get through a full articulation of why this is stupid in the time that I have allotted, but I'm going to give it a shot, so here it goes. First of all, parties do not remain the same over the course of 150 years. You can have the same name that you had 150 years ago. It doesn't mean you're the same party. To think that the Democratic Party, for instance, hasn't changed since the days of Andrew Jackson is ridiculous. And after all, it's Donald Trump, supposedly a Republican and a conservative at that, who hangs Andrew Jackson's picture in the Oval Office. It's the people on the right and Republicans who want to keep his face on the $20 bill. Democrats and liberals in particular are certainly willing, progressives willing to get rid of Andrew Jackson based, if for no other reason, on his mistreatment of indigenous people, his role in the Trail of Tears, his commitment to the enslavement of African peoples. I mean, you know, the modern Democratic Party and certainly modern liberal and progressive folks on the left want nothing to do with him. It's the right that embraces Andrew Jackson. The same thing is true with the Confederacy. It's sort of ironic for the Republican Party to continue to prattle on about Abraham Lincoln when they're the ones who have political rallies where folks show up with the Confederate flag. And a recent survey found that the majority of Republicans believe that that flag is not a symbol of racism, but just a symbol of Southern pride. Now, their forebears in the party would have known better than that. Presumably, Abraham Lincoln would have known better than that. It was, after all, the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens, who said that the cornerstone of that government was the, quote, great truth that the Negro is not the equal of the white man, end of quote. So the Confederacy was absolutely led by Democrats at the time, no question about that. Now, the modern Democratic Party renounces that, all liberals and leftists do, and it's conservatives and the GOP who embrace it. They are the ones who insist that there's nothing wrong with these memorials to the Confederate leadership, all of which were fighting for the maintenance of white supremacy by the admission of their own leaders in every single state that broke away from the Union when they issued a declaration of causes, said that that was the reason they were doing it. So obviously you can't suggest that just because a party has a name that it had 100 years ago, 150 years ago, that it's the same party. The reality is parties aren't even the same 50, 55, 60 years later. Because you can go back, for instance, and look at the 1956 Republican Party platform. That was a very different Republican Party. The party of Dwight D. Eisenhower was a much different party than the party of Donald Trump. The party that we now consider the Republicans, far more reactionary than it was then. Go back, for instance, and read the Republican Party platform from 1956. It's actually fascinating. Just as an example, here are a few things that are in that Republican Party platform, which indicate to you the way that parties change over time, let alone 150 years, but even just within the last half century. So here's what the Republicans said in 56, quote, "We are proud of and shall continue our far-reaching and sound advances in matters of basic human needs, expansion of Social Security, broadened coverage in unemployment insurance, improved housing, and better health protection for all our people." And then later on in the platform, the Republicans bragged about the fact that under the leadership of Eisenhower, quote, "the federal minimum wage has been raised for more than 2 million workers, Social Security has been extended to an additional 10 million workers, and the benefits raised for 6.5 million more. The protection of unemployment insurance has been brought to 4 million additional workers, and there have been wage increases and improved welfare and pension plans for federal employees," end of quote. Not content to stop there, they trumpeted the fact in their platform that year that union membership had gone up by 2 million since 1952. They were proud of that. And later on, the platform actually called for equal pay for equal work regardless of sex. It called for the maintenance of prevailing union wages for employment on public contracts. It called for a further extension of minimum wage laws and providing assistance to improve the economic conditions of areas faced with persistent and substantial unemployment, their words. And the GOP platform called for revising existing labor law so as to protect the rights of workers to organize into unions and bargain collectively. All the stuff they attack now, they were for then. And last thing, the 1956 Republican Party platform called for an Equal Rights Amendment, which would have, had it ever been passed, essentially illegalized institutional sexism in, among other places, the labor market, at least in theory. So that's what the Republicans were standing for. And that's just 60 years ago. right? 61 years ago. So obviously, the Republicans now are not the same as they were in the mid-50s, let alone in the 1860s. The Democrats are not the same because at that time, the time of the civil rights debates, there were functionally two Democratic parties. There were starting to be two Republican parties, interestingly also, but it wouldn't come full circle for a little bit longer. The Democrats, of course, had been split for some time into a Northern or National Party and a Southern Party. And really, they had been at odds with one another going back to the Roosevelt administration. The Southern Democrats always thought that Roosevelt was far too liberal and far too solicitous of black folks. They certainly believed that about Truman when he desegregated the military. They had been at war with the Democrats for a long time. That's one of the reasons they broke away briefly in 48 to try to form the Dixiecrats. There were functionally two parties. You look at the actual vote, for instance, on the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and this is what Republicans and conservatives always point to, and they say, ah, Republicans are the ones who did it. Well, 1964, the first version of the Civil Rights Act that was introduced in the House, the vote was 152 Democrats in favor, 96 opposed. 138 Republicans in favor, 34 opposed. Now, if you just look at those numbers, you might agree with the Republican take on this and the conservative take on this, because the Democratic vote 61% for, 39 against. The Republicans are 80-20 for. But then when you break it down by region, you begin to see that really what it was the South against everyone else. So for instance, the Democrats who were in the South, only 7 were in favor, 87 were opposed. So out of the 96 no votes in the Democratic Party on the Civil Rights Act, 87 out of the 96, all but 9 were from the South. By the same token, although there weren't many Republicans in the South at that time who held elected office at the congressional level, there were 10, and all 10 of the Southern Republicans also voted against the Civil Rights Act in the House. So really, that was a Southern thing. You look at the rest of the party, you look at the what we could call the Northern Democratic Party, but this also includes, you know, out west and in the Midwest. It was 145-9 in favor of the Civil Rights Act. And by the same token, the Northern Republicans, 138-24. Look at the Senate, same thing. In the Senate vote, you had 21 Democratic senators who voted against the Civil Rights Act and only 6 Republican senators who did. So the percentages of support were definitely better for Republicans. But once again, that's all about the divide between the South and the North. The Southern Democrats were 20-1 against it. And the one Southern Republican senator was also against it. So that was the South. You look outside the South, and it was 45 yes votes among Democrats in the Senate to 1 no, whereas for Republicans, it was 27 yes and 5 no. So in terms of partisan politics, the issue really wasn't Democrat-Republican. It was North versus South. It was South versus everything else. So the only way you can really determine which side was really the side of the civil rights struggle is to break out of the party consideration and think about ideology and think about movement politics. Who were the people in the street in the civil rights movement? I mean, where do you think they stood? Have you actually read Dr. King's writings? I mean, Dr. King was very clear. The people in the movement were very clear. What did Dr. King say, for instance, that allows us to recognize him as a clear member of the political left? Well, in 1967, he said the following. Capitalism was built on the exploitation and suffering of black slaves and continues to thrive on the exploitation of the poor, both black and white, both here and abroad. He said that in a speech entitled The Three Evils of Society, which he delivered in 1967. Same year, same speech. He says, quote, "The problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power," end of quote. Also in 1967, and where do we go from here? He wrote, "The majority of white Americans consider themselves sincerely committed to justice for the Negro. They believe that American society is essentially hospitable to fair play and steady growth toward a middle-class utopia embodying racial harmony, but unfortunately, this is a fantasy of self-deception and comfortable vanity." He is saying that white people are essentially deluded and deceiving themselves. That certainly is not something that conservatives say. He also said the year before he was assassinated in the famous speech that he gave at the Riverside Church in New York City that the United States in Vietnam and around the world had become, in his words, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. That's the kind of thing that conservatives will call you a traitor for saying, and they did indeed do so. Shortly before his death, Dr. King was very clearly suggesting that this country had engaged in generation after generation of preferential treatment for white people, and that when he and his cohorts were preparing to go to Washington, D.C. as part of the Poor People's Campaign, which was kicking off right around the time that Dr. King was assassinated, he had the following to say about why they were coming. Listen to Dr. King's own words delivered in his voice, and then you tell me how this fits in with the conservative vision of America.
"At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
And I know some will say, well, this is the older Dr. King. But, you know, the early Dr. King was a conservative. The early Dr. King is one that we identify with, and he would have identified with us. That's what these conservative Republicans suggest. But actually, that earlier Dr. King, if you read his writings, he called for programs that we would now consider affirmative action in 1961 when he came back from India, and he was praising some of the programs in that country that had been set aside for the Dalits, those at the lowest end of the caste system, to provide them some modicum of opportunity in a society where they had never enjoyed it. He said it again in 1963 in a book which I'm sure conservatives have not read because they haven't read any of King's work. 1963, he wrote a book called Why We Can't Wait, and here's what he said. He said, "Whenever this issue of compensatory or preferential treatment for the Negro is raised, some of our friends recoil in horror. The Negro should be granted equality, they agree, but he should ask for nothing more. On the surface, this appears reasonable, but it's not realistic, for it is obvious that if a man enters the starting line of a race 300 years after another man, the first would have to perform some incredible feat in order to catch up." In other words, what King was saying was it wasn't enough to pass civil rights laws and proclaim equal opportunity unless you did something to even out the playing field. The 1963 March on Washington, go and actually look what the platform was that they were calling for. They were calling for housing as a human right. They were calling for full employment as a policy in this country. They were calling for the expansion of the safety net. They were calling for jobs and justice. That was the politics of the left. There were no movement conservatives in the streets of Birmingham fighting for civil rights. There were no movement conservatives getting beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. What were the movement conservatives doing at that time? Well, it's real easy. The movement conservatives in the 1950s and 60s were represented best of all probably by William F. Buckley and the folks at the National Review, who were trying desperately to get the Republican Party to move in a more conservative direction. What did they say? Well, in 1957, in an editorial that has usually been attributed to William F. Buckley, it was unsigned, but most folks believe Buckley himself wrote it, the National Review said the following: "The central question that emerges is whether the white community in the South is entitled to take such measures as are necessary to prevail, politically and culturally. The sobering answer is yes, the white community is so entitled because for the time being it is the advanced race." That's William F. Buckley. That's the National Review. That's the conservative movement. In a March 1960 editorial in the National Review, the magazine said, "In the Deep South, the Negroes are by comparison retarded." And then the magazine used that assertion as justification for why, in their words, quote, "leadership in the South quite properly rests in white hands," end of quote. That's where the conservative movement was. That's the legacy of conservatism as regards race and the civil rights struggle. In 1963, at the time when the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham was bombed, killing four young girls, what did the National Review have to say? Well, they did condemn the bombing because it, quote, "set back the cause of the white people so dramatically," end of quote. In other words, it was going to cause problems for white people. That's what's wrong with this terrorist bombing. It wasn't that it was horrible and immoral and engaged in by white supremacists, but because it might set back the righteous cause of segregationists, which these conservatives believed in. But then it wasn't just that. They went further. And the editors of the National Review actually wondered out loud in the pages of the magazine, quote, "whether in fact the explosion was the act of a provocateur, of a communist, or a crazed Negro," end of quote. So in other words, they actually thought there was a chance that some crazed Negro, their words, not mine, some crazed Negro had killed those four young girls and blown up the church just to set back the righteous cause of white segregationists. That's where conservatives stood in the 60s. Just months before the Voting Rights Act was passed, Bill Buckley took to his syndicated column and wrote that chaos and what he called mobocratic rule might ensue if, quote, the entire Negro population in the South were suddenly given the vote, end of quote. In other words, he didn't believe black folks should be allowed to vote. In September of 1965, in a column in the National Review, a guy by the name of Will Herberg said that the blame for the uprising, the rebellion, or riots, if you prefer, in Watts, in the Watts section of Los Angeles, that the blame for that should be laid on Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement. This is what Herberg said in the pages of the National Review. The internal order is now in jeopardy because of the doings of such high-minded, self-righteous children of light as the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and his associates in the leadership role of the quote-unquote civil rights movement. He put that in quote marks. That's how much disdain this writer for the National Review had for the civil rights struggle. He goes on to say, if you're looking for those ultimately responsible for the murder, arson, and looting in Los Angeles, look to them. They're the guilty ones, the apostles of nonviolence. Why? Because, as Herberg said, for years, Dr. Martin Luther King and his associates have been deliberately undermining the foundations of internal order in this country with their rabble-rousing demagoguery, with their doctrine of civil disobedience. They have been teaching hundreds of thousands of Negroes that it's perfectly all right to break the law and defy constituted authority if you're a Negro with a grievance. This is the position that protests, that encouraging the breaking of unjust laws itself was leading to anarchy and chaos, and that the rebellion in Watts, which I beg to remind you, was touched off by acts of police brutality that had been going on in Los Angeles for a very long time, on top of horrific economic injustice and inequality that the black community had had enough of. That's what set it off, but not to conservatives, not to the National Review. They believed it was the fault of the nonviolent civil rights movement. How dare these people today on the right act as though they are the inheritors of that legacy of the civil rights struggle. They're the ones who today, as you hear this commentary, are going to the polls in Alabama and voting for Roy Moore, not just a child-molesting sexual predator, but someone who recently said that America was great under slavery. The left is the side of the aisle that has fought for racial equity every single time, and the right is the side that has been there fighting it tooth and nail, trying to keep it from happening and then backlashing when it does. And they will continue to be the problem in this country until they and the ideology in which they believe are finally and firmly defeated. So now that we have dispensed with some of the fake news that the right regularly regurgitates when it comes to civil rights and the role of the GOP and conservatives in the civil rights and anti-racism struggles, it's time to dig more deeply into the larger phenomena of phoniness masquerading as information and why we so often fall for it. I'll be speaking with my guest, Gleb Sapersky, about that in just a few seconds. Watch out. So, Gleb, thank you so much for joining me. Before we get into the phenomena of fake news and the current moment where there seems to be this assault on truth and facts, I wanted to explore the larger issue of how we process information as people, how our brains actually work as opposed to perhaps how we think they do. Because in my experience, if you ask somebody, why do you think what you think, they're going to basically say, well, you know, because it's true. And then they'll give you stories and they'll give you anecdotes which they think are proof, or they might point to some information they heard on social media or regular media, you know, that they think proves whatever it is they believe. We all like to think we're logical, but I gather that the evidence doesn't always support that. So as someone who studies this subject, what does the science say about how our brains actually process information?
We tend to think of ourselves as logical, rational, like you said. But in reality, what the research shows is that we're like a tiny logical, rational rider on top of a huge elephant of emotions, intuitions, and gut reactions. So we have two systems of thinking. The logical, rational, intentional system is much smaller and weaker than the emotional, intuitive, the autopilot system. And the autopilot system is much more influential. And this is talked about by people like Nobel Award winner Daniel Kahneman. So the logical system reacts in a second to external stimuli, whereas the intuitive, emotional system reacts in milliseconds. It's a system that pushes out of the way of a moving car, or in the savanna environment, out of the way of a saber-toothed tiger. And it's very powerful, and that's why we survived. We are the people whose ancestors didn't get eaten by the saber-toothed tiger, who didn't go there and think and ponder, should I get out of the way of the saber-toothed tiger, you know?
Right. In fact, if we had done more of that reasoning and logic, we literally would not have survived. So in a way,
exactly. That
lizard brain thing is important. It obviously is valuable, but then it becomes dangerous in an advanced society where we need to be able to have a balance. And sometimes when I look at politics, I think, you know, we're sort of in the current political moment in America, it seems like there's a certain asymmetric warfare, because I feel like to some extent, those who are more liberal, whatever that term we take that to mean, broadly speaking, tend to place this great faith, you know, in the power of reason. So their candidates, whether it's the Democratic Party or whomever, you know, tend to talk in these broad policy terms, like here's what this policy is going to do for you. And they have all the minutiae, and they have all the details, and they have all these facts. However, the other side is much better at what you just mentioned, pushing the emotional buttons. It's sort of like the difference between, like, one party is the cheerleader party and the other party is the debate team, right? And the debate team, the debate team never beats the cheerleaders because the cheerleaders know marketing. So how does this affect our politics right now, in your estimation?
Yeah, well, you know, you can take a look at who was the most popular kids in school, the cheerleader team or the debate team.
Right. I was the debater, and I wasn't hated, but I definitely was not loved like the cheerleaders, for sure.
Exactly. And that's what I talk about in my book, The Truth Seeker's Handbook, A Science-Based Guide. And it talks specifically about how we are pushed by these emotions and how politicians push us and how they manipulate us and how we can prevent this sort of manipulation from undermining and destroying our society. Because that's exactly what it's doing. Oxford Dictionary defined post-truth politics as the successful appeals to emotions and personal beliefs over objective facts dominating the political system. When we are in a situation of post-truth politics, that's when these appeals are successful. And right now we're in this situation. We're in a post-truth political situation, partially because of social media. Politicians are able to get to voters through social media in a way that they previously weren't able to get to them through mainstream media, because mainstream media filtered out a lot of the lies and deceptions and a number of emotional appeals made by politicians. So now that we have people getting their news from social media, they can go to completely biased and partisan websites. Politicians have huge amounts of followers on their Twitter feeds, and they are very influential, much more influential than in many ways than traditional news channels,
right,
who, you know, there are some politicians calling them fake news and undermining the credibility of these traditional news channels. So now we're in a situation where these politicians have the upper hand. We're in a post-truth politics. And you're right, Democrats have traditionally been the party that is more oriented towards science and reason. You know, you're not going to have many Democrats who are going to deny climate change or other scientific-based evidence. And so Republicans in the current post-truth moment are successful not because of their inherent qualities of, you know, they're better or anything like that, but because of the disruptive role of social media.
Right. Well, and social media really rewards rapidity, right? So there's a fastness to it that allows average everyday consumers of it to spread lies much more rapidly. I mean, 20 years ago, 25, 30 years ago, before most people had the internet at all, and even 15 years ago before social media, if I saw something that I wanted to spread, some information I wanted to spread, I would hope it would have been truthful. But whether it was truthful or fake, I was going to have a really hard time finding an audience, right? I was going to have to write a letter to the editor of my paper and hope it got published, or I was going to have to call into a radio show, or I was going to have to print off a bunch of flyers and hand them out on the corner. And so both truth and lies were harder to spread in a sense. Like, even if you wanted to get good information out, it was limiting. So social media, I think, is like this double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's great, right? Because it does allow us to get information in the hands of people in a way that we couldn't before, which, as long as we're using it responsibly, is really fantastic. And on the other hand, as the old saying goes, you know, a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is still pulling on its boots or whatever. And it allows that. So, and we'll talk in a minute about some of the ways we can inoculate ourselves to this. But in particular, since confirmation bias, you know, looking for and then relying upon information that adheres to our pre-existing notions is so common for us as humans, regardless of our politics, we all do it to some extent. How do we train our brains to imbibe evidence and information that might challenge our preconceived notions? Because I gather that it's scary for people to do that. It challenges our worldview. So how do we begin to train our brains to think more critically and logically and not be afraid to do that?
Yeah, so I talk a lot about this in the Truth Seeker's Handbook. And there are certain things that you can do easily, kind of certain tips I can give you that you can easily implement into your everyday activities. The key is to create habits. You know, we learned to recycle. Recycling was, you know, if you remember back to the 1960s, 1970s, that's when recycling began. It was a completely new habit, and now so many people recycle. Well, if people can recycle, they can fact check, right? So there are kind of two components. One is whenever you see a story and whenever you want to share it, first, every time before you share it, fact check. Go to reliable websites, see if it's credible. Go to websites like Media Bias Fact Check, Snopes, factcheck.org, PolitiFact. And those are good venues to check whether the story is reliable and credible. So that's the first one. Second is whenever you see others sharing stories that you think are not credible and reliable, make sure to gently and compassionately call them out. And we can talk about what that means. But if you gently and compassionately call them out, that creates social dynamics. So here we go into the psychology of network effects. Network effects show that if we as an individual stop smoking, then we have a strong influence on our immediate surroundings. So people, our spouse is about 66% more likely to stop smoking if we stop smoking. It doesn't mean that we're going to do anything to push them to stop smoking. It's just because of our behavior and our influence. So if we start fact-checking, that's already going to be great. But if we then encourage them to avoid sharing false information, people on our social network, people who we care about, and if we gently and compassionately ask them to avoid sharing information that comes from not reliable sources or hasn't been fact-checked, that's going to make a huge difference. So these are the two things that we need to learn.
Well, speaking of that issue of compassionately challenging people to do that, because I agree with you. I think, you know, if you write to somebody on Facebook and you say, you know, where'd you get that crap from? You know, they're not gonna respond well to you. You know, every year I'm around this time of year, I do, I primarily work in the field of civil rights and race relations. And so I'll be on the road giving talks at colleges about issues of race in America, and it'll be around holidays. And there will always be that college student who says, oh God, I'm going home and it's Thanksgiving or it's Christmas and I'm going to have that uncle, you know, who's going to say really outrageous, horrible, racist things, or they're going to say homophobic things, or they're going to whatever. And they want to know in that one-on-one situation sort of what to say. And I'm curious what your thoughts are. My advice has always been, don't get in a debate with your uncle. Like, first of all, it's not going to help you. If you go back home and say, well, here's what I learned in my intersectional feminism class, like, your uncle is not going to care. Like, he's going to yell at you. My advice has always been, why don't you ask your uncle some questions that will extend to him, number one, a certain degree of human respect that says, hey, I'm curious why you think what you think. And then you can share what you think and what you've learned or whatever else. But it seems to me a more passive approach that is inviting, right, is helpful. What does your research tell you about those one-on-one conflicts where we've got two people and they've got very different quote-unquote facts in their head? What's the way that we help that person maybe have a breakthrough and or at the very least, de-stress the encounter and make it less stressful for everyone?
So this is a really important area, and this is one I extensively research and speak about. How do you do what I call collaborative truth seeking? And that's the orientation to adopt, not arguments. There's a lot of research showing that arguments and debates, we associated them with war. We associate them with violence. You know, I beat the other side. I attack his position. I undermined his points. It's very problematic when we engage in arguments, because research shows that arguments actually don't change people's minds. So that's not a thing that you want to do unless you just want to have some entertainment. So I've developed a strategy, which is, I describe it as EGRIP. So emotions, goals, rapport, information, positive reinforcement. First, you start with emotions. You don't start with presenting facts. That's not a good strategy. Facts tend to get other people defensive or aggressive. So you start with emotions. You figure out what your uncle cares about. Why is he arguing for the position? You know, let's say your uncle is saying that, you know, all Muslims are terrorists at heart and is really afraid of Muslims. Then, okay, so now you understand what emotions your uncle feels. He feels afraid of Muslims. He feels fear. He feels kind of concerned about terrorism. So then you go on to establish shared goals. That is the goal part of the E-GRIP strategy. So what are goals that you both share? Now, you might care about civil rights for Muslims more than you care about security and so on, but you also have some concern for security. So for the sake of a productive conversation, talk to your uncle. How about, hey, totally understand. We both care about security. We both care about safety. How can we be more secure? Then you go on to build rapport. So that's where you express, validate your uncle's emotions. Don't say that your uncle's emotions are wrong. Say it's natural to feel fear and anger. I totally understand where you're coming from. Don't say that his emotions are leading to the right actions, but validate his emotions. If you invalidate his emotions, you will harm your relationship and undermine your ability to positively influence your uncle. And then you go on to saying, well, how can we make sure to reach the mutual goal that we care about? So orient toward your goal in this part of building rapport, safety and security. Let's talk about how engaging with Muslims can build safety and security. And then you go on to the information. So, for example, last year, according to research, there were about 9 Muslims involved in terrorist attacks in the United States. And there are about 1.8 million adult Muslims alone. So, you know, the chance of you, of any Muslim adult that you see engaging in a terrorist act per year is 1 in 200,000. That's like picking out, a random terrorist from several football stadiums. So basically, by focusing our efforts on Muslims, we're going to miss the actual terrorists because we have limited resources of safety and security and policing. Also, the FBI tells us that Muslims are quite helpful in pointing out extremists within the ranks. So if we police Muslims more heavily or do the Muslim ban, which is currently passing thanks to Donald Trump, Muslim communities will be less likely to help us. And thirdly, negative rhetoric against Muslims is already being used. Donald Trump's rhetoric against Muslims is being used as a recruiting tool for terrorists by organizations like Al-Shabaab and so on. So all of these things are making us less safe. Focusing on Muslims and having anti-Muslim policies that are making us less safe, not more safe. So talk about how that is problematic, that it's going to be a real danger to our safety and security if we have anti-Muslim policies. So even though we might feel afraid about Muslims, actually having policies targeting them, very explicitly punishing Muslims, will make us less safe and secure and will make terrorist attacks more likely. And then you go on to positive reinforcement. That's the P part of E-GRIP. Reinforce your uncle's ability to change his mind. What you want to do here is associate positive emotions for him with changing his mind and orienting toward the truth. So this is the crucial strategy. And this is a strategy I go on conservative talk shows quite frequently. And I talked about this way with Scott Sloan, a prominent conservative Christian talk show host, after a terrorist attack nearby where I work at Ohio State University. And he updated his beliefs. He said, yes, we should, based on this information, even though I feel afraid and angry toward Muslims, I should treat them in an inclusive manner and not support anti-Muslim policies.
Well, and it sounds like the key, right, is that it's not that information isn't important, because I do think there's sort of this binary thinking that people engage in where, like, if you see the brain science research, which I know and I've looked at it, that says, facts are not what change people's minds, then there's this extreme reaction that says, okay, well, then let's forget all the facts. Like, we can throw them out. It doesn't matter at all. Let's just try to appeal to emotion just like the other folks appeal to emotion. Rather, what you're saying is you got to deal with the emotional affective piece first. Once you do that, though, and you create some trust and you create some connection with someone, then you can bring in the factual information without it seeming like a threat to their identity, right?
Yes, that's exactly what you want to do. You want to focus on creating positive emotions and building up trust and rapport. And this technique won't work if you don't establish shared goals. So it's actually aligned with their goal sets. It works in many cases. It won't work in cases where their goals are completely opposite from your own. You're not going to convince, let's say, somebody who is completely, for religious reasons, doesn't want their women to have abortions, right, to permit women to not have abortions. But it works in very many cases where people are simply being rational, which means that their decisions and their activities are going against their own goals. And that's very frequently the case in post-truth politics situations, because people are manipulated by politicians who are trying to brainwash them into believing things that are actually harmful for them to believe.
Right. I mean, it's sort of the difference between, let's say, somebody who has been led to believe for 40 years, they've been hearing that if you just cut taxes on rich people, all wonderful things will happen and it will trickle down. And of course, the evidence says pretty conclusively that that's not the case. And yet a lot of working class people who are not rich, who do not benefit directly from the kind of tax cuts that are being proposed right now, they still believe it. That to me is less of a hard thing to break through than, let's say, someone like at this Pensacola rally that President Trump had, where this warm-up speaker got up and basically implied that by recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, they were going to bring about Jesus coming back. And, you know, I mean, like if your identity is wrapped up in the second coming, that's going to be way harder, right? That's going to be much harder to break through than somebody who just has maybe the wrong idea about taxes.
Yes. And the wrong idea about taxes is going to be a really important thing to break through.
Right.
Just like the wrong idea about Muslims and the wrong idea about a lot of these things. The wrong idea about environmental change. I mean, how many people have the wrong idea about that? And that's devastating our future.
Right.
So that's the big danger.
Do you think that one of the things I think about a lot as someone who I speak on, you know, 50 or 60 college campuses a year, and a lot of the people to whom I speak, you know, they're ensconced in an academic setting where they've got wonderful scholars in many cases in front of the room every day teaching them all kinds of things, and they're experts in their content. One of the things that I hear, though, from students sometimes is that they feel overwhelmed by factual information because sometimes it's presented in this like purely academic way. And so I think sometimes the way that people are impervious to facts has to do with the presentation. What I like about your work is you have really gone out of your way in your book and in essays that I've read of yours to try to make these scholarly ideas accessible to people and break it down in a language that isn't just like, you know, a scholarly academic journal article that gets read by 30 people, right? How can scholars, because here's the thing that I worry about. I know that colleges and universities do not really reward writing for a popular audience. I mean, if you're an academic, they want you to write for journals. They want you to write in language that most people do not have access to. How can we encourage scholars to both do that, because that's part of the gig that they have, but also to spend some time trying to break things down for average everyday readers? Can schools encourage that? Should they encourage that? How do we find the balance there?
I think it would be wonderful to encourage that, but it would take departments changing their evaluation systems.
Yeah.
And that's hard. So I'm an academic. I don't get any reward for, you know, doing interviews like this one,
right,
or, you know, going on with Scott Sloan. But I do change minds. I change the minds of his listeners. I change his mind, and I change the minds of other people. And I'm passionate about this because I care about what I see as the demise of democracy in my country. Now, in order to change the system so that other people, other scholars who don't have such a civic passion like me, do what I do, you need to change the incentives. And that's, I don't think that's going to happen easily. I think that's something that we need to get major movement on from the college leadership perspective. So get administrators to change this, get donors to colleges, because, you know, that's where they rely on a lot of their funding. Get donors to colleges to make requests for this to happen, and then you'll see change.
Maybe one of the ways to do that is using sort of one of the techniques that you're bringing up, this idea of sort of compassionately challenging the existing thinking, because, you know, there's a lot of backlash and a lot of hostility towards the academy right now, and it's coming from some of the very same forces who call everything fake news, and they're launching these attacks on the academy, and they're wanting to defund entire programs. And you've got folks in various states that are saying, you know, if it's a department that doesn't lead directly to a job, it's not a real department, you know. And so it seems to me like maybe administrators might be open to a very compassionate, non-confrontational approach that says, listen, you're under attack. Maybe one of the ways that we could make institutions less under attack is if we encourage scholars to speak not only for other scholars, but speak to average everyday folks and respect their listeners' ears as well, because I think sometimes it's the sound of elitism coming from the academy, right? It's the inability to break things down in regular language that folks look at it and go, well, what is all this high-minded, academic, you know, pointy-headed intellectual talk, rather than saying, no, actually, we're going to take these concepts and break them down so that everyone can relate to them and participate in them. I mean, maybe it's about sort of breaking down some of the walls between the academy and the community, yeah?
I think that would be great. It needs, like I said, incentives. People's incentives need to change. And there are lots of people, college administrators and so on, definitely academics, who don't have incentives and who are blinded to the dangers that are posed to them. And that's, you know, something that I'm trying to work on, how to get academics to change their perspective and collaborate on effort that addresses fake news, addresses post-truth politics and so on. And that's part of what the Pro-Truth Pledge is about at protruthpledge.org. That's a behavioral science-based instrument where a bunch of academics, including myself, got together and tried to figure out how can you very clearly and easily and simply change incentives for people to orient toward truth and facts instead of lies and fake news? How can you get public figures, politicians, journalists, and so on, to make a public commitment to truthful behaviors? And so what we did is we looked at the research on what makes people lie and what causes people to orient toward the truth and boiled it down to 12 simple behaviors that clearly correlate with the facts. And for folks who are in their mobile devices or by a computer, you can go to protruthpledge.org and check it out. So one of these behaviors is the first one that we talked about at the beginning of the show. Fact check information to confirm it's true before accepting and sharing it. Another is reevaluate if my information is challenged and retract it if I can't verify it, and ask people to retract information that reliable sources have disproved, even though those people are my allies. And celebrate those who retract incorrect statements and update their beliefs toward the truth. And 8 more behaviors like this that are clearly oriented toward truth-telling. So by getting people to go to protruthpledge.org, again, that's protruthpledge.org, signing the pledge, private citizens and public figures, we can actually make a big change in our society to orient toward these behaviors.
And then what do we do in those cases where someone, because of course, no politician is ever going to acknowledge, oh yeah, I lie. I lie all the time. I lied yesterday. I'm lying today. They all want you to think that everything they say is true. And the fact that I think the fact check organization said that something like 2/3 almost of Donald Trump's statements prior to the election, or maybe even since, have been for Pinocchios or whatever, you know, which is the highest level of dishonesty. But I'm sure he would say, you know, he's very truth telling. So let's say a politician signs the pledge, and they may sign it with all sincerity. They may mean well when they do it. But of course, when they then sit down and they say, okay, in the world of politics, my concern is keeping power. So like, for instance, those folks in the Congress who fundamentally are committed to the notion of cutting taxes on the wealthiest Americans, who I have to assume have read the same research I've read that says that that isn't really going to do all the things they say that it will do, but they are ideologically committed to it. So they can sign the pledge, but they're still about mobilization on behalf of their constituency. So what happens if everybody signs this pledge, but one side continues to focus most on the pushing of the emotional buttons that they know will rile up their base? So they say, build the wall, and they say, ban the Muslims, and they say all these things, knowing that that works. And then the other side is committed to the science and the facts and the nuance, which is morally and ethically a lot better. But in practical campaign terms, how do we try to make sure that people are held accountable when they sign that pledge, but they don't really follow through? What are some things we can do?
So for people who are on the website right now and looking at it, you can look at the FAQ, frequently asked question number 3, how are pledge takers held accountable? So that's the combination of crowdsourcing with behavioral science. You know, Wikipedia has been able to build a huge, huge repository of quite accurate factual information. In many ways, it's actually more accurate than many encyclopedias through crowdsourcing. And so that's the aspiration that we have for the Pro-Truth Pledge, having pledge takers hold public figures accountable. So if a public figure makes an inaccurate statement who has taken the pledge, I'll give you an example of somebody who did. So Michael Smith is a candidate for Congress in Idaho, and he put a tweet on his Facebook wall that's where Donald Trump was criticizing disabled children in public classrooms. And it had a bunch of shares, something like 18 shares, And then we looked at the tweet, Donald Trump's tweet feed, and it wasn't in Donald Trump's tweet feed. And so either Donald Trump deleted it or somebody photoshopped a tweet to look like Donald Trump's feed. So we went to Michael Smith and asked him to retract it. And he made a retraction post on the same post. He said, well, because he couldn't find it, so I can no longer verify that it's an accurate post because I took the pro-truth pledge.
Right.
And that's kind of how the accountability system works. For example, if somebody says this tax cut will definitely lead to improvement of an economic situation, you can go and look at the consensus of most economists who say no, that it won't lead to the improvement of our economic situation. It'll actually add greatly to our debt burden. And you could say, well, where are you getting this information? Cite your sources as the pledge requires. That's kind of one of the behaviors. And if he won't be able to cite his sources, he'll have to retract that statement or be considered in violation of the pro-truth pledge. Now, just for that occurrence, if somebody does sign it and after makes an accurate statement and then we go to him, is reported, we go to him after a number of tries to get him to retract his statement. If he doesn't, then we place him in contempt of the pro-truth pledge. Then we would issue a media release to all the media in that person's district. So let's say if it's Michael Smith, to all the media in Michael Smith's congressional district, then we will send an email action alert and a text action alert to all the people in Michael Smith's congressional district who signed the pro-truth pledge, asking them to email Michael Smith, tweet him, call him, protest his office to get him to retract his statement, and also list him as in violation of the pro-truth pledge and in contempt of the pro-truth pledge on the website, and ask him to retract all of the information on his website saying that, I took the pro-truth pledge.
Right. So it's like taking back the organic seal on the mm-hmm. on the food. It's like you said you were organic.
Yes.
You're not really organic. We're gonna make you we're gonna rescind your good housekeeping seal of approval, kind of thing.
It's like the Better Business Bureau.
Right.
You get a Better Business Bureau seal because you practice honest ethical business practices. If you stop practicing them, the Better Business Bureau will revoke it. Public figures who have taken the pro-truth pledge and who have been with the pro-truth pledge for a while, people can trust them to be much more credible and factual than people who haven't.
Sure.
And that's the difference. So it will be unlikely that people who make empty claims about the tax plan will sign the pro-truth pledge. By contrast, people who make accurate claims about the tax plan will sign the pro-truth pledge. And that will be a very quick way of giving voters information about who they should trust. So that's the essence of the pro-truth pledge.
Well, that's fantastic stuff. And I've got one final question, because I think about this a lot too. I work with, in addition to speaking at colleges, I work a lot of times with teachers in high school and middle school and even elementary school level. And one of the things we talk about a lot and that they worry about with their students is that, young people in particular are more than any generation previously just being bombarded with so much information, some of it good, some of it bad, some of it really bad. And they want to know, as educators in the classroom with fifth graders, eighth graders, 11th graders, whatever the case might be, how they can do a better job of helping with media literacy, helping young people sift through the contours of the things that they're seeing and be able to know when something is more truthful or when it's less truthful. Do you think that there's some applicability to the work that you're doing at that level? And if so, have you worked with teachers in those kind of situations or with young people to try to give them the tools to develop a more discerning eye and ear towards truth?
Yeah, absolutely. So my book, The Truth Seeker's Handbook, A Science-Based Guide, is used by some teachers in their curriculum to inform their teaching. And because it has, like you said, it's aimed toward a very broad audience. And it's something that middle schoolers and so on, it's not used with kind of younger kids.
Sure.
But with teenagers, that's something that's easily applicable and that they can apply. Teachers are also using the principles of the pro-truth pledge and trying to integrate them into their school teaching. So we have, for example, a social science teacher who is developing curricula around how to have school projects that use the pro-truth pledge and have each of the 12 behaviors of the pro-truth pledge be taught during 1 week of the semester, and then have her students create content about the pro-truth pledge, things like podcasts, each of the behaviors, podcasts, essays, and so on. Fantastic. So that's a way that school projects are made aimed toward the pro-truth pledge, so integrating them. And she's trying to work them into making sure that they meet the state requirements, educational requirements. So yes, it's something that is definitely being integrated into the school curriculum, but in order for that to really take off, we need people on school boards to take the pro-truth pledge. And for private citizens, basically the essence of the pro-truth pledge is that the more private citizens go to protruthpledge.org and take it, the more incentives people in various public roles have to take it. Here in Columbus, Ohio, where I live, we have a particularly large number of volunteers because I was able to go to a number of venues, give speeches about it, and we have a number of people who took it. And by now, we have a number of officials in city council positions, in school board positions, who have taken the pro-truth pledge because so many private citizens in this area have taken it. And so the more people in any area take it, the more likelihood public figures will have to take it.
Well, if folks want more information about the pledge, about its principles, and about how to take that, and then to let people know that they have taken it, how do they do that? Give me the website again, and how can folks find out more?
Sure. So it's protruthpledge.org, and they can also find out more about the principles of the pro-truth pledge and all of this behavioral science behind it in my book, The Truth Seeker's Handbook, A Science-Based Guide. This is a systemic problem, and I invite everyone to be part of the solution, not part of the problem, and go to protruthpledge.org and sign it as well. And Tim, I invite you to sign it as well.
I would love to do it. And one of the things I was going to say, I think that when we're trying to hold people accountable, one of the ways it appears to me would be, you know, if you're trying to get someone else to change behavior, the best way is to admit, number one, that you've done some of the same stuff that they do. I mean, we've all made these cognitive errors. We've all made mistakes on social media. And I've gone back over my Twitter feed, my Facebook feed, and I found at least three that I found over 10 years, which, you know, better than some, but still three too many, of stories that I fell for that turned out not to be true. And in each case, I went back, I retracted the story and acknowledged, you know, the mistake that I had made when it was brought to my attention or when I discovered it myself. And it seems like sometimes, you know, a little humility. Like if I go to someone and say, hey, look, I've made these same mistakes and I'm trying to do better and I want you to do better, it's also less threatening, right? It's not me judging you. It's me saying we all are susceptible and we all have to try a lot harder.
Absolutely. I think having that perspective of being humble and orienting toward telling people, hey, I made some mistakes as well, it's okay, helps build up that rapport and helps people change their minds. It helps them see that you're vulnerable. And vulnerability is a powerful thing for building up rapport and having trust. So
absolutely.
I think that's very wise.
Absolutely. Well, I will go and sign it. I'm going to encourage my listeners to do the same. I thank you so much for joining me and hopefully stay in touch and find out that the pledge is spreading and folks are taking it and that they're actually doing what they say the pledge tells them to do. So it was great talking to you. Thank you for taking the time.
And thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure.
You bet. Take care. For those interested in learning more about the Pro-Truth Pledge and taking it yourself, you can do so at protruthpledge.org. And by all means, grab a copy of Gleb Sapirsky's new book, The Truth Seeker's Handbook, A Science-Based Guide, on Amazon or whatever online outlet you prefer, or even better, at a brick-and-mortar bookstore, presuming you're still lucky enough to have one of those around where you live. That'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show, and look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song Gather Round as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time.
higher than the flames grow, higher than the poor, and the fires can inspire and decide to.